The History of the World podcast, written and presented by Chris Hasler. Welcome to the History of the World podcast magazine. Hello everyone, welcome to the History of the World podcast magazine. In the midst of chaos here at the Hot World Studios, we've got the decorators in, so it's an absolute mess here. So I've had to just set up a temporary broadcasting setup and just go for it. This week we're going to continue what we've been doing for the last three magazine episodes and looking at great events in history. I think this has been quite a good little series, and I've got five more events to focus on. What we do, we look at these events and then go back into the archives of the History of the World podcast and find out some things from broadcasts gone in, broadcasts of yesteryear, basically. So we're going to be dipping back into the archives of the History of the World podcast. Last time, we were talking a lot about sort of the ancient world, really, the beginnings of Greece, ancient Greece and Rome. We was looking at the beginnings of Rome and some of the biblical stories of the Middle East. This week, we're going to look a little bit more closely at some of the events that followed that period, sort of in the middle of the first millennium BCE. The first one we're going to look at is the development of Greek society, recorded Greek society, what we really know as ancient Greece. And a lot of it began in Athens. So we're going to focus a little bit on Athens. We're going to look at some of the statesman of Athens. We're going to start this week with Solon, the renowned Athenian statesman and poet who implemented significant constitutional and judicial reforms around 594 BCE. These reforms were a response to the conflict between the landed aristocracy and the peasantry in early 6th century Athens. Solon's reforms aimed to address economic inequalities, enhance the Athenian economy, and create a more inclusive political structure. His legacy continues to shape our understanding of early democratic governance in ancient Athens. In Athenian society, the laws of Draco did not last long, and a reform was necessary at the start of the 6th century BCE. If the health of Athens as a polis had been good under the aristocracy, then this problem would not have existed. The fact of the matter was that Athens was now responsible for the outlying lands of the Attica Peninsula, as well as the city of Athens itself, and that Draco's law code had just not solved the bigger problems, and the health of the Athenian polis was vital as it needed to economically compete with its neighbours to avoid being overrun. Farmers of the Attica Peninsula were being consigned into slavery, and this was not healthy for the polis as a whole, which needed a healthy agrarian industry to facilitate the ever-increasing population. So another man was invited to reform the Athenian legal system, and his name was Solon. Solon would expunge the debtor-slavery laws of Draco and allow the debts to be eliminated so that society could start afresh. The harsh laws were removed so that you would not necessarily fear for your life if you were caught scrumping. Solon would also make important political reforms that would give more political opportunity to people outside of the aristocracy. So it might seem a little confusing to understand why the aristocracy would allow such a thing to happen in their polis. This is what I think was on their minds. If we look at what else was going on in the Greek lands in the lead up to this time, then we have to consider the rapid ascent of Sparta, a polis on the Peloponnese to the south of Athens and Corinth. Sparta had conquered the Messenians in the late 7th century BCE in its own quest for expansion and wealth, and its growth and power would certainly have been a major concern for the Athenians, who would have expected the Spartans to become a major rival. The Spartans had become adept in warfare as they were taking over the lands of the Peloponnese, and the Athenians would have understood the requirement for having its own intimidating army to make the Spartans think twice about challenging Athens. So the Athenians had their own army, which is fairly well known to historians as it contained the famous phalanx formation style infantrymen, who we refer to as the hoplites. Military personnel were very valuable to the polis during this period, and their obedience and loyalty to their respective polis was vital to its fortunes. It is fair to say that the hoplites of the Athenian army were not part of the aristocracy, and that the hoplites would have relied on a successful agricultural industry to not only feed them and their families, but also to enable the Athenians to successfully trade with other societies in order to keep the polis economically strong. If Athens was not economically strong, then it may lose the loyalty of the hoplites, who would either migrate away or even prop up a tyrant such as Chilon, who may forcibly take control of Athens. So it would have been really important to make people outside the aristocracy, including the valuable hoplites, feel like they could have an influence over their polis's fortunes. It would still be the wealthiest people of the polis who would have the greatest say in politics, but it would not be restricted to the aristocratic families of Athens as it had been previously. Another important political reform of Solon was to expand the right to vote beyond the city of Athens itself, to beyond and including the lands of Attica in general. As we already know, the Athenian council was held at the Areopagus Rock in the shadows of the Acropolis. The Areopagus Council was generally made up of those elders who had previously served as archons to Athens, and the archons were the elected heads of department who would be the heads of Athenian politics. Being elected, the archons would be the rulers of Athens, but would ultimately be accountable to the Athenian aristocracy who elected them and replaced them each year. Even though the Areopagus existed as a consultative council of elders who would supervise the decisions of these serving archons, Solon would create a general assembly called the Ecclesia, who would be made up of regular Athenian citizens and would elect the archons themselves, meaning that ultimately the people who made up the Areopagus would contain retired archons who had been elected by the citizens and not the aristocracy. This was a major step towards a much more inclusive way of ruling the polis, and what some describe as a very democratic move. After Solon declared his reforms, he promptly left Greek lands and left Athens to its fortunes. We're going to come back to Athens later on in the magazine. But now we're going to move on. It's going to be the same century, but we're going to go back to a story which we spoke about in the last magazine, which was the Jewish exile to Babylon. And this time we're going to talk about Cyrus the Great, the founder of the Achaemenid Empire and king of Persia
from 559 to 530 BCE. He played a pivotal role in the liberation of the Jewish people from captivity. Cyrus's actions not only ended the Babylonian captivity, but also left a lasting legacy on Judaism. Without his intervention, the Jewish people and Judaism as we know it today might not exist in the same way.
Now, if you recall, after the fall of the Assyrian Empire, the lands of the former Assyria were split between two empires, with the Median Empire to the north and the Babylonian Empire to the south. The period that followed has already been mentioned during Volume 2 of this podcast, and specifically during Episode 10 on the ancient religion of Canaan and Phoenicia. As Assyria was falling, this would have dire consequences for the Egyptians, who would be helpless in watching the fall of their only Near East ally at the time. The Egyptian pharaoh Necho II would lead an Egyptian army to Carchemish to stand alongside the remnants of the Assyrian army against the Babylonians, led by their king Nebuchadnezzar II in 605 BCE at the Battle of Carchemish. But the Babylonians would see off the Egyptians, sending them back to Africa. In the aftermath, the Babylonians would annex the ancient kingdom of Judah and its capital city of Jerusalem, a city which would rebel against their new rulers by delaying their tribute payments. As a result, King Nebuchadnezzar II of Babylonia would deport the Jewish people of Jerusalem to Babylonia after plundering Jerusalem and destroying the sacred Solomon's Temple during the siege of Jerusalem in 587 BCE. The feelings of the deported Jews in Babylonia are captured in Psalm 137 of the Hebrew Bible. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Also, we wept at our remembrance of Zion. On the willows, in the midst thereof, we hung up our lyres. From there, our captors demanded a song, and our desecrators mirth. Sing us from the song of Zion. How can we sing the song of God on strange land? Zion is another name for the lands of Jerusalem, the lands that the Jewish people call their home, and the sacred land that the Jewish people yearned to return to. The words of this particular psalm have resonated through the ages with seemingly countless musical renditions over the course of modern history. One of the most well-known in pop culture was the version recorded by the Euro-Caribbean pop music group Boney M, released in 1978. The Babylonian captivity of the Jewish people would continue until the Jewish people were freed, and they were freed by none other than the hero of today's episode, Cyrus the Great. After Cyrus's successful conquest of Lydia, he would turn his attention south towards the Babylonian Empire. Firstly, Cyrus would need to secure those northern Elamite lands centred around their capital city of Susa in 540 BCE. This would bring Cyrus to the doorstep of the Mesopotamian lands of the Babylonians, now under the rule of King Nabonidus. Cyrus would be able to strike the Babylonians in the following year, engaging them in battle at the Battle of Opis. The Babylonians were no match for Cyrus's mighty Achaemenid Persians, and the Babylonians would crumble in defeat, allowing Cyrus to march into Babylon and be proclaimed the new king. The Babylonian Empire would now become a part of the Achaemenid Empire, which would include Jerusalem. Those captive Jews who wished to return to Jerusalem would be allowed to do so, where they would begin construction of a new temple to replace the one that the Babylonians had previously destroyed. Not all Jews would return to Jerusalem, and those who would not return would be the ancestors of the more modern Iraqi Jews. Historians cite the Babylonian conquest by Cyrus the Great as a good thing. The Babylonians have been portrayed as the bad guys in this episode in history with their apparent bullying of the Jews. However, the Kingdom of Judah did have a reputation for being a stubborn people who would resist the imperious attitudes of the Babylonians and the Assyrians before them. Whatever your opinion is, it does appear that Cyrus would allow the Jewish people the freedom to live their lives wherever and however they pleased. The Kingdom of Judah was a relatively small part of Cyrus's imperial ambitions. One other important expansion of Cyrus the Great's reign, which can sometimes be overlooked, is the eastward expansion. With all the glory of victory over the Medes, the Lydians, and the Babylonians, we should not neglect Cyrus's success in extending his influence over the lands right up to the Indus Valley. This would be the first time that the Indus Valley would be linked to Mesopotamia within the same empire. It is possible that Cyrus would attempt to campaign northwards towards the Kazakh steppe, where he would meet a Scythian people called the Massageti. Herodotus, the Greek historian, is quite fair in his assessment that there are multiple theories, but it is during conflict with the Massageti that we suggest that Cyrus the Great met with his death.
Now, moving even further east, let's talk about Prince Siddhartha, who later became known as the Buddha. And he achieved enlightenment during a pivotal moment in his life. The moment of enlightenment under the Bodhi tree transformed Siddhartha into the Buddha, and his teachings continue to inspire millions around the world. The significance of Siddhartha Gautama is that he was a prince who became the Buddha, and therefore the founder of Buddhism. However, Siddhartha Gautama was born into a royal family within the Indian subcontinent, which predominantly observed Brahmanism. Siddhartha Gautama would ponder on the aspect of Vedic faiths that humans continually reincarnate until they have been enlightened. Siddhartha Gautama observed the suffering of humankind going on around him and looked for a way to make sense of it. He would take great amounts of religious advice and engage in meditation to discover the truth. He would turn his back on his affluent royal upbringing, and although he opted against the suffering of total poverty, he would practice self-denial to an extent. There were already monks living in total self-denial in their quest for enlightenment, and Siddhartha Gautama practiced such asceticism before concluding that this was not the answer. Siddhartha Gautama would teach a different way, where his students were encouraged to live a life without desire in order to attain the enlightenment required to break the cycle of reincarnation. Later in his own life, Siddhartha Gautama would legendarily sit under the Bodhi tree and attain his own level of enlightenment, and from then on, he would be known as the Buddha. The Bodhi tree is a sacred fig tree located in the modern Indian state of Bihar, and the site is now known as Bodh Gaya. An iconic statue of the Buddha, reaching almost 20 metres in height, exists at this sacred Buddhist site now, with many monasteries. The Buddha's teachings are represented by a wheel which can still be found at the centre of the Indian national flag to this day. So here we see the historical divergence of what we know today as Buddhism from what would become Hinduism. But we must be very careful when trying to categorically state any information relating to the ancient differences and aspects. Buddhists are often said to follow the Shramanic traditions, which include non-violence towards humans and animals, and asceticism, or a life of austerity, in a quest to achieve moksha, which is the breaking of samsara, the process of being reborn after each of their deaths. However, we must be quick to state that Hindus also pursue moksha, even though they are Vedic and not Shramanic. However, some commentators state that Shramanic traditions predate the life of the Buddha and even find their roots in Vedic scripts. So the traditional lines between Hinduism and Buddhism are blurry, according to which commentators you choose to believe. Next, we go all the way back to Europe again, and this time it's Rome, where we're talking of Lucius Tarquinius Superbus, also known as Tarquin the Proud. Now, he was the legendary seventh and final king of Rome. His reign lasted for 25 years until a popular uprising led to the establishment of the Roman Republic. Tarquin's arrogance and tyranny led to his downfall, marking the end of the Roman monarchy and the beginning of a new era in Roman history. Servius Tullius had an enemy from within, and he was likely to be a direct descendant of Tarquin the Elder, and his name was Lucius Tarquinius Superbus. Known to history as Tarquin the Proud, he is thought to have been responsible for the death of his first wife and a husband of his second wife on his ascent to power. He usurped the throne of Rome by murdering Servius Tullius at the beginning of a reign of terror. Tarquin the Proud was responsible for the execution of a number of Roman senators, while Tarquin attempted to rule Rome as an absolute despot. During the reign of the later kings, the power of the Etruscans was still growing, with Etruscan influence extending all around Rome, and Rome would have surely been a city that the Etruscans would feel more comfortable about if all of its power was diminished. And this might explain Tarquin the Proud's behaviour. As the descendant of an Etruscan noble family and a Corinthian immigrant into Etruria, which was the name of the Etruscan lands. The nobleman Lucius Tarquinius Collatinus was married to an admired woman called Lucretia. And Lucretia was raped by the son of Tarquin the Proud, called Sextus Tarquinius. Lucretia committed suicide in shame, and Tarquinius Collatinus's cousin would step up in his cousin's honour. His name was Lucius Junius Brutus. Brutus would gather all the young men of Rome and expel Tarquin the Proud's son from the Roman army's camp, in an event which saw the Roman army turn against the king. As such, the king could not re-enter the city and had to flee into exile. The Roman monarchy had been overthrown, and Tarquin the Proud did not want to surrender his power. However, he was unable to regain power and decided to approach the Etruscan king of the city of Clusium, and in 508 BCE, King Lars Porsena of Clusium attempted to besiege Rome. The Etruscans got the better of the Romans on the field of battle to the west of the city, but the Romans retreated back over the Tiber River and within their city walls, preventing any further offensive from the Etruscans. Ultimately, there was a peace treaty, but this actually meant that the monarchy was now over. The Romans hadn't enjoyed the last 20 years under the rule of a despotic king, and decided that future kings should have limited powers, not unlike the Archons of Athens, for example. For all intents and purposes, Rome was now a republic. Collatinus, the husband of the tragic Lucretia, and his loyal cousin, Brutus, served as consuls during the first year. The story of the Republic will continue next time. This week's episode is highly concerning, however, with all of these kings described as semi-mythological, and many of the events skewed by dramatisations and depictions seeking to glorify them. However, we could say similar things about a number of historical stories from the ancient era about every society, as we are simply reiterating interpretations and, in the light of multiple accounts, the popular and most influential interpretation of the day. So although this week we have told a wonderful story of the Roman kingdom, there is a possibility that none of it ever happened. Our final trip back into the archives of the podcast takes us back to ancient Greece, as promised, back to Athens, where we're going to talk of Cleisthenes of Athens, born around 570 BCE and passing away around 508 BCE. He holds a significant place in history as the founder of Athenian democracy. His contributions reshaped the political landscape of ancient Athens. Cleisthenes' vision transformed Athens into a beacon of democratic governance, where the power truly rested with the people.
We learned earlier in the episode that the Athenian tyrant Pisistratus died in around 527 BCE, and the tyranny of Athens continued in the hands of Pisistratus' sons, Hipparchus and Hippias. Many of the nobility of Athens opposed the tyranny, and Hipparchus was assassinated in 514 BCE, leaving his brother Hippias in sole charge of Athens. One of the noble families, called the Alcmaeonids, would make a name for themselves at this point, and they would use the highly regarded Oracle of Delphi to influence events. The Alcmaeonids, knowing the Spartans to be very pious, would bribe the Oracle of Delphi into advising the Spartans to attack Athens. This would be an unprecedented move by the Spartans, who had otherwise been fully occupied with conquering the Peloponnese. The Spartan king was Cleomenes I, who was a true Spartan king, very interested in subjugating those troublesome Peloponnesian neighbours, such as the Argives of Argos. It should maybe come as no surprise that Cleomenes was interested in having a direct hand in Athenian politics and fortunes. Cleomenes would initially dispatch an army to conquer Athens and put an end to the reign of the tyrant Hippias. The first Spartan attack on Athens was unsuccessful, so Cleomenes decided to personally lead the follow-up attack. Hippias was not ready to submit to the mighty Spartans led by their king Cleomenes, so the Spartans took those people dearest to Hippias, and Hippias finally conceded defeat, having been trapped on the Acropolis and effectively under siege. The Spartans would spare the lives of the Pisistratids if Hippias agreed to abandon and leave Athens for good, and so this would be. Sparta had successfully ended the tyranny of the Pisistratids, and the Alcmaeonids would make their move to take control of Athens fronted by a man called Clisthenes. Clisthenes, often pronounced Cleisthenes, had some very clear ideas about how Athens should be ruled. He suggested that Athens be divided up into 140 voting districts called demes, and these demes would represent the entire population demographic of the Athenian polis. So you would have demes representing those people of the city, demes representing the arable lands of Attica, and demes representing the mercantile people of the coast and the associated artisans of their communities. Demes would be grouped into tribes with absolutely no regard for geographical location to ensure that each tribe would have a fair mixture of the different society types of the Athenian polis. This would be in a bid to ensure that every citizen could be represented as fairly and as equally as possible, and that favouritism of a particular demographic was suppressed. 50 members of each of the 10 tribes would be called forward to create a 500-strong council of citizens called the Bouli. The concept of demes was not a new concept, but it was now that we see a practical use of the demes concept in order to create an impartial representation of society, and so this is the origin of the modern word to describe the concept of democracy. And Clisthenes is celebrated as one of those people at the forefront of the creation of the concept of democracy. Clisthenes himself was not granted a clear passage to take a prominent position in Athens following the expulsion of the Pisistratids, though. We have discussed previously how years were named in antiquity, with there being no numerical naming in the way that we know it today until the late classical and early medieval period. However, the years would still have names, and often they were named after a monarch and the accumulative year of their particular reign. In Athens, all people of prominence were traditionally replaced annually, so one of the archons himself would be called the eponymous archon, and the year would be named after him. Clisthenes himself had been the eponymous archon back in 525 BCE, which is something that has confused historians who believed that all members of the Alcmaeonid family were banished from Athens. In 508 BCE, the eponymous archon was a man called Isagoras, and Isagoras would prove to be unpopular with Clisthenes, pushing his fantastic new idea of a democratic society, which excited the people enough to want Isagoras to be replaced by Clisthenes. Isagoras would turn to the man who had influenced the events in Athens in the first place for help, King Cleomenes of Sparta. Isagoras would have believed that it was his right to be the chief magistrate of Athens, and King Cleomenes clearly saw an opportunity to support a legitimate and pro-Spartan man at the head of Athenian politics. Clisthenes would flee Athens as the Spartans would successfully take control of Athens once again, with Isagoras citing the curse on the Alcmaeonids, justifying the expulsion of Clisthenes from the polis. However, the citizens of Athens, with their promise of a democratic polis, were not interested in a pro-Spartan tyranny, and they would entrap Isagoras and his Spartan allies where else but the Acropolis once again. If you were on the Acropolis and under siege, you would ironically rarely have the higher ground in a dispute. Isagoras and the Spartans had no option but to surrender to the citizens of Athens, who would even slaughter a number of Isagoras' supporters just to make the message clear. There isn't anything to tell us about Isagoras' fate after this incident, but he was consigned to history as the Athenian people welcomed Clisthenes back to Athens, where his democratic model, which Clisthenes called isonomia rather than democracy, would flourish.
Thank you very much indeed for listening to this week's magazine episode. And if you're listening to this podcast, you think, oh, do you know what? I'd like to do something to help out. If you enjoy this podcast, then please support us. Visit our website, historyoftheworldpodcast.com. Click on the Patreon link and sign up to make a monthly contribution. You don't have to donate loads, just even from $1 a month. It's absolutely fine. Whatever you can afford. It really, really helps. You'll become a lifelong member of the History of the World podcast Illuminati, and you'll qualify to receive gifts and rewards. This week, we welcome to the History of the World podcast Illuminati, Walter in Dumfries, Virginia. Thank you very much, Walter, and welcome to the History of the World podcast Illuminati. Now, if you'd like to get in touch with the podcast, then please do drop me a line at historyoftheworldpodcast@mail.com. I love receiving your emails. You can also follow this podcast on Facebook, X, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, Tumblr, Threads, and Mastodon. If you want to find all of those links, you can go to the Interact section on the website.
Listener messages and reviews.
Received an email from a good friend of the podcast, Andrew Berman, who put, hello Chris, I've been meaning to write again and the article shared below prompted me to finally do it. I most certainly trust this note finds you well, having had a nice holiday season, enjoying your new chair and of course taking care of yourself too. This is very important. Did you get married yet? Don't forget to take time for your spouse too. Also very important. As noted, I recently saw this article. I'm guessing you saw it already, but I thought I'd share it with you just in case you hadn't. There's a link relates to Ötzi the Iceman. Of course, if you remember from way back in volume one? We spoke about Ötzi. It must have been volume one. Well, it's all about new views on how Ötzi's tattoos were made. Frankly, I'll never be able to hear about Ötzi without thinking of you. I also just finished volume 4, episode 71, part 2 of the Mongols, and its debrief. The debrief captured exactly what I was thinking while listening to episode 71. That there's an awful lot going on in the world at the same time. So you connecting the dots was appreciated. I'd forgotten, for example, that the bubonic plague is born during the Mongol reign. I'm going to look for that source material you mentioned. History year by year, as it sounds like something I need to keep track of it all. That's the book History Year by Year by DK Books. As always, loving the podcast and its journey and grateful for all you're doing. You're a kind friend who's always there for us. With kindest personal regards, Andrew Berman. Thank you, Andy. Don't forget to post that link to our social media pages. That will ensure that the entire Hot World community, all the Hot Worlders, can enjoy reading about Ötzi's tattoos. So thank you very much, Andy. We've got a bit of a bulked out weekend, haven't we, this weekend? So we've got this magazine episode. Then tomorrow, we've got the episode about the Battle of Ain Jalut between the Mamluks of Egypt and the Ilkhanate. And then also we've got the debrief episode that comes out. So you've got three for the price of one this weekend. So don't forget to tune in tomorrow night and listen to our episode of about the Battle of Angerlut. But until then, thanks for listening. Be good.
The History of the World podcast, written and presented by Chris Hasler. Please consider making a financial contribution by going to the historyoftheworldpodcast.com website and clicking on the Patreon link. Email the show at historyoftheworldpodcast@mail.com. And don't forget to join our social media at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. See you next time.